Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. WikiLeaks has just leaked a chapter of the secret international trade deal, Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. President Obama has long championed the TPP as a major part of its global economic policy platform, but the New York Times has analyzed the WikiLeaks document and concluded that if signed into law, the TPP would enable foreign companies to sue the U.S. government if their businesses were hurt. According to the Times, quote, under the accord still under negotiation but nearing completion, companies and investors would be empowered to challenge regulations, rules, government actions, and court rulings, federal, state, or local, before tribunals organized under the World Bank or the United Nations. The leaked chapter is an indication of the ongoing push from major multinational corporations that seek to expand their power at the expense of ordinary people and governments. Part of that expansion is a new merger announced this week of two major food companies, Heinz and Kraft Foods. The new mega company will become the fifth largest food company in the world. My guest is Patrick Woodall, research director and senior policy advocate for Food and Water Watch, a public policy analyst, researcher, and advocate on economic justice issues in Washington, and co-author of a book on the World Trade Organization. Welcome to Uprising, Patrick.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's turn to the TPP and this new chapter on investment that was leaked to WikiLeaks. The New York Times described these extremely broad powers that this chapter outlines. But what is an example of what could happen if this version of the TPP is realized and becomes law? What are the sorts of worst-case scenarios we could see in the U.S. in the future?
Well, the new chapter confirms pretty much our worst fears about the negotiations. It does empower foreign companies to challenge any law that they believe indirectly expropriates their profits. And that means really what they call a reasonable investment expectation. So that could be any kind of very common sense public health, environment, or consumer protection that actually infringed on future earnings. So if you were a polluting company and a law was passed to curtail that pollution, that would infringe on your investment expectations. And the company would be empowered in new powerful ways to bring a challenge against that state or local or federal government for damages. They could sue for money damages to get the government to change its law to eliminate the protection or to pay out a giant sum of money. And so far under NAFTA and other trade deals the U.S. has signed, trade tribunals have already imposed almost $4 billion in penalties for these kinds of investor-to-state disputes, which are a huge threat to democracy and a threat to kind of the growing movement on empowering people to really take control of their own lives.
I mean, it sounds as though corporations believe they have a right to profits, but they don't have a right. I mean, that makes no ethical sense. It makes no moral sense. And up until recently, didn't make much legal sense either.
Well, I mean, this really calls into question some of the rhetoric coming out of the White House. They've said that it's no different than under U.S. law and that U.S. companies actually can do the same thing. But that's only true in the real property sense. So originally, these investment measures were designed to ensure that if a company's land was seized by a government for, you know, a new highway or something, they would have the same sort of eminent domain rights that you would have in the U.S. So if we ran a right-of-way through someone's land, they have to be compensated for that. But these are new kind of versions of this that actually expand those ordinary investment rights to a whole range of hypothetical and future expected earnings rights on a regulatory takings area, which is not the case under U.S. law. And so it is a huge expansion of the power for foreign companies to actually challenge local laws. Now, look, I mean, we're concerned about this on a host of things. This will affect things on food labeling. It'll affect the growing movement across the country to fight fracking for natural gas. There are 250 communities across the country that have passed bans or moratoriums on fracking within their boundaries, including New York State. And these could all be threatened by international trade tribunals where foreign natural gas companies could challenge a local ordinance. This is not a hypothetical problem. Already there's been a case under NAFTA where a natural gas company has challenged the Canadian province of Quebec's moratorium, which is in place for them to study the impact of fracking on the St. Lawrence River system. So this is a real problem, and we have people across the country that are fighting to protect their communities from natural gas expansion with dangerous fracking, which pollutes their water and communities. And this is a way for the companies to do an end run around local government.
And some have characterized the TPP as NAFTA on steroids. Essentially, what it sounds like to me that you're saying that if we summarize this, the TPP essentially puts corporate interests over the interests of people and the planet. I mean, I can't think of any other way to put it. Is that a good way to look at it?
That's absolutely right. It prioritizes corporate interests over the public interest. And this particular chapter, these investment provisions, are really the tip of the spear on this. It gives companies an express right to bring these challenges on their own. Under the World Trade Organization, if there are commercial disputes, they are brought from nation to nation. The U.S. government challenges another government's rules. Under this, it just eliminates all that and allows the companies themselves to take action into their own hands. So there's not even that element where the government chooses to do it, which has a little bit of protection from democracy. But this is just allows the companies to run roughshod over local governance worldwide.
And we are able to have this discussion because somebody leaked a copy of this chapter to WikiLeaks. They're doing these discussions in private and secret. How does the Obama administration justify this? I mean, we've already eviscerated this idea that the Obama administration is the most transparent in history, its claim. And in so many other ways, of course, it's the least transparent. But in this as well, it seems to be holding fast to its lack of transparency.
They're actually quite insistent on the lack of transparency, and they've made it very difficult even for members of Congress to get access to the text as it's being negotiated. This recent leak actually highlights this in a very appalling way. Included in the investment chapter that was leaked by WikiLeaks, there is a four-year confidentiality clause inside the investment provision, which says this investment rules cannot be shared with the public for 4 years after either the trade deal goes into effect or the negotiations fail. So even these provisions are so damaging and so demonstrate the kind of corporate power that these trade deals are based on that they don't even want to share it with the public until long after it's gone into effect.
Now, people pushing the TPP have been very optimistic for years that negotiations on the final language would wrap up and that the governments of all of the countries, because there's a number of countries involved here, not just three like NAFTA, that the governments of all these would vote on it and it would become the new international trade deal. How close is the TPP from being finalized and voted on here in the U.S. and elsewhere?
Well, I think the negotiations have been much slower than anybody would have wanted that's pushing this deal. They're down to a few areas of contention, but they are contentious areas, I think. So they have been having meetings and ministerials on this, but it is not moving as quickly as they anticipated. They thought this would be wrapped up a few years ago, and it's still ongoing. It's a 12-nation pact all around the Pacific, so Australia, Canada, Chile, the U.S., Southeast Asian nation. So it's a big pact that has a lot of complexity to it, but it is not finished yet. In the U.S., it doesn't appear that this deal will come to the congressional floor in the next weeks or even months. And in fact, they're trying to push a retrograde way of approving this deal, rubber stamping the deal known as fast track right now. But even that has kind of slowed down a little bit in recent months.
Patrick, let's turn to the other story that exemplifies the increase in corporate power. You work at Food and Water Watch, and two major food companies, one of them especially major, Kraft Foods, announced a merger this week with Heinz. And these are two companies which together would basically make the fifth largest food company in the world. How is this going forward? What are your concerns for it?
Well, I think it was announced just recently this week, and it will go forward, I expect, pretty rapidly. These are big companies, right? Within the U.S., this is the fourth biggest Kraft and the 11th biggest Heinz, and they would have as much as $22 billion in sales and domestically. So they're huge companies. I mean, they're sprawling. They have a sprawling presence inside the supermarket that many consumers may not know. I mean, obviously, Kraft is macaroni and cheese and salad dressing and Velveeta and whatnot, but it also owns a host of brands that people might not think of as Kraft brands, like Maxwell House Coffee or Clausen Pickles. Heinz is sort of a similar but smaller company. It also owns not just ketchup, but Ore-Ida potato products and Weight Watchers frozen dinners and things like that. So we're very concerned about the impact this has on consumers because it's really changing the choice that consumers have and making it considerably harder for consumers to know who owns what they're buying and what the control is like within the supermarket, which ultimately really diminishes choice and has the real potential to raise prices over the long term for consumers.
How is this not seen as violating antitrust laws? I mean, we're supposed to have these laws in place to prevent mergers, but corporations seem to find ways around them. Is it that the two companies say that they produce products that don't compete with one another, so it's okay?
Well, that's basically, in a nutshell, what it is. And the Federal Trade Commission, which oversees these mergers, likes to look at these cases through a very, very narrow lens. They want the companies to compete on nearly identical products. There's a kind of infamous case where they only wanted to look at very strong mints, and one company did not produce very strong mints, the other did, and so they didn't view this as a competition problem. In this particular merger, it's a merger of two conglomerates that produce various kinds of foods, but they do compete on a couple of narrow areas. So Kraft produces A1 steak sauce, and Heinz produces Lee and Perrins Worcestershire sauce. And in those cases, there is a direct competition. The problem is there are many other places where there are kind of complementary goods that are produced. So Kraft also produces Grey Poupon mustard and Clausen pickles, and Heinz produces ketchup. And in theory, this is going to change the way that people shop for things at the barbecue, right? So it does have a real competitive impact. And more broadly, what we're looking at is a kind of wave of mega mergers in the food industry. There were $100 billion worth of food and beverage mergers in 2014. And in the past couple of months, we've seen a merger between Bumblebee Tuna and Chicken of the Sea Tuna. Smucker's bought the company that owns Milk Bone and Meow Mix. There's a big breakfast cereal merger between Post and Malt-A-Meal, which is being proposed. So it's a big deal. And throughout the supermarket, we see fewer and fewer firms that are controlling, that have their tentacles all over the supermarket. What this means is we have really an illusion of choice. You stand in the supermarket and it looks like there are an infinite number of brands, but the reality is those brands are really controlled by a few firms, and that control prevents new companies from selling new, more natural, or products that people may want that are emerging, because it's much easier for Kraft to control real estate in the supermarket because they can sell a huge variety of things. We did a study that found that Kraft was present in 22 of 100 kinds of grocery products, and Heinz was present in 7. And in many cases, they're the dominant player. So it's 80% of macaroni and cheese is by Kraft, and half the processed cheese, and a third of the mayonnaise, and a third of the lunch meat. So they have a huge presence, and this merger will join companies that will spread their power throughout even more of the supermarket.
Right. Doesn't that also make it harder for smaller food companies to break in? I mean, you know, there's a growing awareness around food related to the impact on public health. And when you have smaller companies that are trying to put foods on the shelves, to be able to compete with these larger and larger companies, not only for the costs, but for shelf space, it makes it much more difficult, doesn't it?
So I think that's really what we're talking about. This is it's very hard for new food entrants to get into the marketplace. And, you know, they're competing for the real estate in the supermarket, which is the shelf space, but I mean, it's the promotional space and the ability to advertise in store. And all of those things are constrained when you have a huge, huge company that controls so much space. And they work in very close alignment with supermarkets who are also merging. We just had a big Albertsons-Safeway merger that was approved by the Federal Trade Commission. So, you know, it creates this cascade of mergers. The supermarkets get bigger and they have more power over the manufacturers. The manufacturers merge so that they have better deal with the supermarkets and the people they buy supplies from. And the kind of supplier companies merge so they can cope with the manufacturers. All these companies in the middle are getting bigger in a wave after wave of mergers. And the reality is that we have about 2 million American farmers, 310 million eaters, and just a tiny handful of firms in the middle that make all the choices and extract all the value from the food chain.
And of course, when they merge, it increases the drive to cut costs further, which then leads to using cheaper ingredients that are worse for our health, and all of these very much a part of the conversation around public health. Well, I want to thank you so much, Patrick, for joining us today and helping to shed some light on the ways in which corporate interests are trumping the public interest. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. It was great to be here.
Thanks. Patrick Woodall is Research Director and Senior Policy Advocate for Food and Water Watch and a Public Policy Analyst, Researcher, and Advocate on Economic Justice Issues in Washington. This is Uprising. We'll be right back.